Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the escalating military activity in Gaza, where Israeli forces are massing on the border for a possible ground invasion following naval commando raids on sites where Hamas is launching rockets aimed at Israeli cities. We will go to Israel and speak with Avram Berg, a former leader of the Labour Party and the One Israel Party, who was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003. We will discuss his latest article at Haaretz, The Refugees First, and the absence of any clear endgame when it comes to Gaza, the policies of the Israeli right, and the lack of a vision from the Israeli left, where in each case it appears tactics have supplanted strategy. Then we'll go to Cuba to speak with Mark Frank, a freelance journalist based in Cuba, who works for Thomson Reuters, The Financial Times, ABC News, The Economist, and Argentina's Clarín. We will discuss Russian President Putin's visit to Cuba, Nicaragua, Argentina, and Brazil, where after the World Cup final, he will attend a summit of the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa. We'll examine Putin's forgiveness of Soviet-era Cuban debt and economic development underway in Cuba with the new Brazilian finance port and free trade zone in Mariel that promises to position Cuba as a Singapore of the Caribbean. Then finally, we will look into the new internet-based businesses like Uber, Lyft, and Sidecar that are threatening the long-established taxi industry, as well as the room rental service Airbnb that is impacting the bottom line of existing hotel chains. Matthew Mitchell, a professor of economics and a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, where he's the lead scholar on the project for the study of American capitalism, joins us to discuss his article in Sunday's Los Angeles Times, "If You Like Uber, You Would Have Loved the Jitney," and political intervention by the taxi lobby to curtail the growing popularity of emerging new business models. And now joining us from Israel is Avram Berg, who's the son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in politics as a leader of the Israeli Labour Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of Knesset from 1999 to 2003 and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. And his latest book is Liberal Interpretations of the Five Books of Moses. And his latest article at Haaretz is The Refugees First. Welcome to Background Briefing, Avram Berg.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And at this point, what's the latest news from Gaza? We've been hearing for some time the possibility of a ground invasion with military forces massing on the border. Apparently, there's been a call by Israel for the Gazans to evacuate the north of Gaza, which apparently is underway. So what's your latest there on the ground, Avram?
It looks like the show of time, which means the Israelis are collecting, or we are accumulating forces around the borders, attempting or threatening to walk in. Hamas is doubling their air force to launch as many missiles as possible. And this is, all of it happens when at the background there are increasing voices talking about somebody to walk in and to mediate. Will it be the Germans, the Turks, the Qataris, or the Egyptians? Nobody really knows, but the talks about the end of this the round of violence are already on air. So it's a last effort to improve, it can be a longer one, but to improve positions towards the negotiation.
And surely the Egyptians wouldn't be hosting the negotiations. Isn't Hamas being squeezed now because the new Egyptian military government is opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood that Hamas has sprung out of? So they're losing international support. They're pretty isolated. Is this some sort of last act of defiance on their part?
Well, last in the sense that tomorrow morning they're going to disappear, I don't think so. There is a feeling that maybe everybody in the region is isolated one way or another. I mean, the Egyptians did not yet gain the international status of honest brokers or even handed brokers because, as you said, they're not really popular among the political Islam. Hamas is isolated because of the terror nature and because of the kind of the way they terrorize both Gaza and their behavior all around. Israel is not very popular around the world as well. So it's actually a conversation of the non-popular, the non-supported, who try to find a way, not necessarily to reach a strategic goal, but at least to survive the next tactical stage.
And Avramberg, there's some interpretations that Hamas that are suggesting that Hamas is motivated by the fact that there are even more extreme groups trying to supplant it on its right. And there are also reports that, for example, Israel's foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, in a cabinet meeting, basically stood up and challenged Netanyahu's manhood and said, you know, you don't have the cojones to take care of this problem. Is this situation being driven by the right on both sides? Because my understanding is that there are a lot of, there's an emergence now of a lot of right-wing demonstrations in Israel. And recently, I think it was a week ago, Tzipi Livni, the justice minister, went on television and warned about these so-called price tag attacks. So a lot of questions there. Let's start with the resurgence of the Israeli right. Is there manifestations of right-wing demonstrations across Israel?
Listen, in a situation like this, in a kind of a chaotic Israel, and Israel is in a chaotic situation for a long, long time, and it's a place in which the freedom of speech is more than unlimited. Everybody can say whatever they like. You have right wing, you have left wing, but I will separate the right wing positions into three. First, there is the political rhetorics of those who know that whatever they will say, nobody is going to implement their policy, and therefore they can gain popularity among their ranks, but nonetheless without risking the real future of Israel. The second is the more moderate one, like Netanyahu and others. Well, whatever the reason why they are reluctant, be it a weakness, be it understanding and comprehension, they're not going to move on. I think because mainly they realize that unlike Karl von Clausewitz, which said that policy is the continuation of war in different means, or war is the continuation of policy by different means, here war is the continuation of the previous war by the same means. And therefore, it's just a waste of energy and a waste of everything just to gain a couple of more months, a couple of more weeks of tranquility without moving into the real political move. And the last but not least is something that was expressed right at the eve of this escalation, and this is the brutal assassination of an innocent, lovely Palestinian kid from Shuafat in a very malicious way by right-wing extremists, which I believe might indicate a kind of a serious moral deterioration at the outskirts and the suburbs, so to say, of the political legitimate right. Around the political legitimate right, there is a getting thicker belt of non-legitimate one, which is heavily saturated by violence, by incitement, by religious, eschatological, messianic, and extremist expressions of religion. There we have a serious problem.
Again, I'm speaking with Avram Berg, who's a son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in politics as a leader of the Israeli Labour Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1992 to 2003, and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. And his latest book is Liberal Interpretations of the Five Books of Moses. And he has an article at Haaretz, The Refugees First. But there was a very disturbing article in the New York Times a couple of days ago, Avram Berg, that suggested that the Israeli Shin Bet and other political leaders on the Israeli right knew from the outset that these three boys that were kidnapped had been killed. Apparently, one of the boys' cell phones was active, and it revealed the sound of a gun being fired. There were bullet holes in the car and blood in the car, etc. All of which was, according to the New York Times article, was withheld from the Israeli public as a deliberate means to incite people to be furious and to keep the hope alive that somehow these kids would be alive, when in fact, very cynically, some of the intelligence people knew that they weren't. So is there any substance to those charges?
Who knows? Let's wait for more details to come. I take it that during the trial, a lot of information will be revealed. My suspicion is that this is a tip of an iceberg.
Meaning what?
There are many more like this murderers.
And
many more like them out there.
And does this go back in a kind of DNA sense to the assassination of Rabin?
It all comes from the same neighborhood. I mean, in the last couple of decades in Israel, most, if not all, the political lethal violence is coming from right to left. It is mainly religious right, ultra-religious right, fanatical, messianic. But these are the quarters in which we have to investigate. And my feeling is that part of the intelligence community does not really want to know how to infiltrate or penetrate these places in order to prevent the next assassination.
Well, I'm sorry my Hebrew is not up to scratch, Avram, because your article...
So is my English.
Well, you're doing a lot better than I am. Your article in Haaretz, the Refugees First, is extremely literate and very colorful. But in my opening, I took the liberty of trying to encapsulate your position, where I said that there is an absence of any clear end game when it comes to Gaza, the politics of the Israeli right, and the lack of a vision from the Israeli left, where in each case it appears tactics have supplanted strategy. Is that a fair assessment of your position?
That's a nice introduction to my introduction. My argument is saying we have a round after round after round of the same thing. Okay, so we go from place to place and from escalation to escalation, but where does it lead? And when you do not have a clear vision of your target, you must ask yourself, where is it coming from? So there are many reasons for the deterioration of violence. But there is no doubt, nobody would argue it, that maybe the main one, the original one, is the birth of the refugees problem, which is 48. Many of us left-wingers love to say, let's solve 67, the occupied territories, and the story is over. It's far from being over, because in 48, by the birth of the independence of the State of Israel, was born the tragedy of the Palestinian people, that hundreds of villages were evacuated or actually kicked out of the place and expelled, and millions of people, hundreds of thousands at the time, and with their descendants and offsprings nowadays, there are millions of people are still refugees. So what are we to do? To continue? If the more you ignore it, the more you realize this is actually the nucleus reactor, the nucleus fuel of all of the fuel of hatred of all of these rockets. So if you really, as an Israeli leader or an Israeli strategist or an Israeli citizen, wants to prevent and to stop all of this hatred, you must address or try to address the original reason. And I say, usually, traditionally, what we did is we actually said, okay, we solved Jerusalem, we solved the borders, we solved security, then we shall come finally as a carrot by the end of the process to the refugees' problems. And I say, oh no, doesn't work anymore. Let's do refugees first, before the political process, before the peace process, before any intervention. Let's solve it, because humanly it's the right thing to do, and politically it's even profitable.
Well, the thesis there that the idea that tactics have supplanted strategy, that reminds me of the Israeli documentary feature that was up for last year's Academy Award, called The Gatekeepers, which featured the former heads of just about every former head of Shin Bet and the Mossad, the intelligence services, both domestic and foreign. And all of them unanimously said the same thing, that we're all about tactics and not about strategy. And then until we address the Palestinian issue, Israel's never going to have any real security in the neighborhood.
Well, I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, these are the experts of some of the best intelligence gathering and security keeping organization in the world. And all of them, I mean, all the leading heads of this organization, they are saying the same thing. This should have set some kind of an alarm in certain quarters of Jerusalem. It looks as if Netanyahu is a bit deaf to these sounds.
So, is this to say then that ideology has supplanted pragmatism?
Say it again.
Does this mean that ideology has taken over from pragmatism? Because most intelligence people and military people are fairly pragmatic, and they try to avoid ideology because they've got more important things to do. Whereas ideology is the luxury of a politician.
Well, I don't know, because in the political sphere in Israel, in the political realm in Israel, there is no real ideology. There is a rhetoric of ideology, but not real, deep, profound ideological thinking. I don't see neither a pragmatical approach nor an ideological approach. I simply see a kind of a political system that drifts from crisis to crisis, from escalation to escalation, with no real hand on the helm, which tries to navigate it or to steer it away from the next storm. That's the tragedy of it.
Right, but you mentioned the history of the refugees from 48, and of course Gaza was essentially a big refugee camp. But what my sense is, though, that Netanyahu and the Israeli right have never had a clear end game of what they want with Palestine
They have an end game.
What is it?
They have an end game. The basic end game is that, never mind what is the political eventuality, they want the greater land of Israel, which is the piece of territory between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, to be as long as possible and forever is not a short term. Under the Israeli property and under the Jewish sovereignty, and they will do the utmost to preserve it, this way, that way, whatever way. This is the real end game. Sometimes they use a lot of tactics for it. Sometimes they use some strategy for it. But this is the end game, and this is a foolish one, because historically speaking, there is no such a thing as the promised land. In the long history of 3,500 years of the Jewish people, there are couple of sets, 7, 8, 9, 10 sets of different borders of the greater land of Israel. And give me a situation, I'll give you a historical precedent. And the second one is, even if you want it, what does that mean that you try to lead an actual people in actual reality according to 2,000, 3,000 old precedent? It's actually, you dig deeper into the past and you do not allow your people any future. And this is what they're doing. They're dragging us into the mud and the swamps of the past, though with a very creative interpretation of it, without offering any real hope for the future. That's a tragedy of Netanyahu's leadership.
But this idea of, on the Israeli right, of Judea and Samaria, and it being Israel's birthright, or in other words, God is somehow the real estate agent here. What about the Palestinian people? What's the vision for them?
There is none.
So you mean
there is a feeling that this real estate agent of yours one day will appear as Deus Ex Machina, which is God out of the machine, okay? and will make them disappear. They have a feeling that God is not just a real estate agent, but is David Copperfield as well. And he will make all the Palestinians disappear. This will never happen. So this is the thinking should be not just do we have a right to the place, but how do we reconcile our right with the Palestinian right? That's a kind of thought. This is the kind of thought that I think that the current right in Israel is ill-equipped to address.
Well, just a final question then, Avram Berg. We talked earlier about the manifestations of right-wing demonstrations, and I believe that the Jerusalem football team is a magnet for a lot of these sort of right-wing soccer hooligans, etc. And they run around saying death to Arabs. Is that affecting the Israeli Arabs themselves? Because at some point or other, is it possible that Israeli Arabs will start, who are Israeli citizens, will start feeling aliens in their own country?
I love your modest thought. They feel deprived and they feel, excommunicated for a long, long, long time, maybe since 48. There was only one period, which was Yitzhak Rabin's period, in which the Israeli Palestinians, which is the Palestinians who are legitimate, legal, formal citizens of the State of Israel, ever had a kind of a policy, governmental policy of respect and acceptance and trying to equalize or to level the field between the Jewish majority and the non-Jewish minority. But ever since, the right in Israel developed its own version of democracy, and democracy is for them just the rule of the majority. Who cares about the minority? Who cares about rights? Who cares about birth rights? Who cares about constitutional safety nets and rights of the individual, of the collective? And therefore, many, many, many Israeli Palestinians feel that we live here, but in a way we are in exile at home.
Well, Avram Berg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for interviewing me.
Again, I've been speaking with Avram Berg, who's a son of Holocaust survivors. He has been active in politics as a leader of the Israeli Labor Party and the One Israel Party, and he was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003, and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and his latest book is Liberal Interpretations of the Five Books of Moses, and he has an article at Haaretz, The Refugees First. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back and go to Cuba. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Cuba is Mark Frank, who's a freelance journalist based in Cuba, who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and consults for ABC News, and has contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín, and is the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuban Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Frank.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. And Vladimir Putin, Russia's president, was just in Cuba, and then he went on to pay a surprise visit to Nicaragua, and then on to Argentina, and then on Sunday he is in Brazil for the World Cup, after which there will be a BRICS summit in Brazil. And of course, BRICS are the emerging economies of Brazil, India, China, and South Africa. Let's start with Putin's trip to Cuba. It does feel like, I imagine, to American policymakers that Putin is sort of meddling in their backyard. And of course, Putin has been arguing that NATO and the United States have been meddling in his backyard in Ukraine. So are there any of those dimensions in this trip, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you have to put it in context, and that is both countries for a number of years have been trying to repair as much as they can their relationship, which, of course, went down with the Soviet Union. That has been building now for about 15 years. But it does seem now to be becoming much more important. The Russians recently basically forgave an old debt to the Soviet Union and have pledged to invest $3.5 billion into the Cuban economy. And there is some oil exploration going on. But again, Russia right now is still like probably the fourth most important trading partner in Europe. Spain, Italy, the Netherlands all have more trade. And there's really almost no Russian investment right now in Cuba. So yes, at least symbolically, it looks like they're going to pick up their relationship. But we have to wait a bit and see what really happens.
But in terms of real investments, isn't there a huge project underway at Mariel for a big deep water port and a free trade zone that the Chinese are investing in? Is there a potential for Cuba becoming kind of a Singapore of the Caribbean?
Well, first of all, there's neither Chinese or Russian investment right now in Mariel. It was actually Brazil that funded the project, not the Chinese and not the Russians. The project is now done in terms of the first phase, and they've declared a special economic zone for a much broader area around the port. And they're hoping that both Russia and China will begin to invest in that area, though so far there is no investment.
So this has been led by Brazil, and it's quite mature from what you're telling us, Mark Frank.
Yes, yeah, so Brazil invested, basically they didn't invest, they loaned money to Cuba to build it, about $850 million, and a Brazilian company actually formed a joint venture here and actually built the project using, of course, the Brazilian funds.
So what's your sense then of the extent to which the U.S. is missing out? There's been arguments for some time that because of the embargo, European hotel companies and others have got a march on the U.S. in terms of the tourist trade in Cuba, which I imagine it's not that developed yet, but it has enormous potential. So is this yet another example of the embargo costing the U.S. if the Brazilians are already developing this huge port and this free trade zone?
Well, there's no question about it. There's no question. Everybody agrees, all the experts, whether they're for the embargo or against the embargo, it's pretty unanimous that the embargo hurts the U.S. economy, hurts, you know, U.S. companies, and hurts, you know, employment, especially in Florida. So clearly this is just one more example of it. There are, of course, thousands and thousands of examples. There's lots of countries that everybody in the world trades with Cuba, except basically the United States. Everybody in the Western Hemisphere has totally normal relations with Cuba, except for the United States. So obviously, it's not the type of embargo that's, you know, for example, with Iran, where a number of countries have joined in, just the opposite.
So, Mark Frank, you're in Cuba. What was the local reaction to President Putin's arrival and the forgiveness of the Soviet-era debt of, I think, about $30 billion? Of course, when Russia pulled out of Cuba, they left Cuba high and dry. In many ways, the way that the Cubans adapted, particularly not having any energy supplies, they were suddenly cut off, might actually be an example for what the world will be like after oil. But I guess that's another subject. But give me a sense of, I imagine there was some bitterness about the Russia abandoning Cuba, but was any of that expressed in this visit by Putin?
No, not at all. I mean, that's long gone. That's 20 years ago. Cuba is in the process of very important economic changes. There'll probably be political changes very soon as well. So know, if Cuba, you know, forms better relationships with anybody, the Cubans are happy about it. They don't really have a problem with it. They're more worried about their day-to-day lives and how to improve it.
So in that regard, how do you explain this strange disconnect that the U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Cuba has been controlled by the so-called Miami Cubans for the longest time, and that explains this antiquated and outdated and counterproductive boycott and Radio Martí and these other more absurd examples of this long frozen Cold War contest that's been going on. But at the same time, I understand that a lot of Miami Cubans fly in and out of Cuba to meet with their relatives and obviously bring with them hard currency and other consumer goods, etc. So how's that navigating between the cracks, I guess?
Okay, well, first of all, I talk to a lot of Americans and groups here when they come, and that's always a question. And the first thing I say is this: imagine, or actually when there's a room full of 30 people, I say, okay, and I lift up something that's green, and I say, well, what color is it? And everybody says, it's green. And I say, well, what would be your reaction if you saw red and everybody else saw green? Well, you'd probably want to go to the eye doctor and check out, you know, whether you're colorblind. And that's the case with U.S. policy towards Cuba. It's really an isolated policy at this point, both internationally and, in fact, more and more in the United States, and, in fact, more and more with Cuban Americans. Why do we keep that policy? I think it's just pretty easy just to blame it on the Cuban American exiles. But I think it's a little more complicated than that. I think it's just very hard for the country to get over a policy that has failed for 50 years and say, okay, well, we really do have to change. And the U.S. really does have to change. There's no question about it in terms of its policy towards Cuba. But I think it's not just the Cuban Americans. I think it's a little more complicated than that.
So is that to suggest that there are parts of the U.S. government that are still angry at Castro? I mean, is this just an old habit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's no question that we have a very hard time accepting that Cuba's different. It's like Cuba's a dissident in the world, and you know, we don't like it. We don't like how they treat us. We don't like how they talk about us. And, you know, so, yes, I think it's hard. You know, there's a certain amount of emotion that's involved. We don't like, obviously, a communist country right off our shore. And so I think it's not just the Cuban Americans. I think it's psychological to some extent, actually.
But that's not to say that the Cuban people, aren't they fairly friendly? I've talked to people who've traveled to Cuba, and they say that the Cubans are extremely welcoming.
No, absolutely. The Cubans love Americans. Most Cubans have family who live in the United States. The Cuban government has always been very careful to differentiate between the government and U.S. people. So I've lived here for 20 years now, over 20 years, raised a family here. I've never run into any anti-Americanism whatsoever. So it's not a matter of the people, I think, on either side as much as the governments.
But surely there's also this other phenomenon of so many Cubans trying to get off the island. So where does that stand in terms of...
Well, that's not, you know, that's not really complicated. First of all, you know, young Cubans have an opportunity that no other young people on the planet have. And that is if they step one foot into the United States, be it over the border, the Mexican border, or visiting family, and they say, I want to stay, they're not treated as illegal aliens. They're treated as, you know, just the opposite. They're welcomed, they're given financing, and they're given their residency, and they're given their citizenship. So this is a tremendous opportunity for people, and many take it as they would anywhere. And so the phenomenon of Cubans leaving, yes, Cubans leave. People leave all kinds of countries.
Well, of course, that you have to put that in stark contrast with what's happening now with 57,000 young Central American kids.
Exactly. You know, they have two holding pens along the border, one for everybody and one for the Cubans, because everybody else gets thrown out and the Cubans get welcomed. And if you put them all together, somebody's going to get mad at the Cubans. So there's actually two different processes at that border for people sneaking in, completely different processes.
So just returning to President Putin's trip both to Cuba, then to Nicaragua, and then on to Argentina, where they talked about nuclear power deals. And we know Argentina, of course, is having tremendous problems with this debt forgiveness deal that the Supreme Court just blew up by siding with the 8%, 92% of the creditors had agreed to a haircut, but then this so-called vulture fund refused to agree, and the Supreme Court ruled in their favor. And that's created a lot of uncertainty over Argentina's economy, which has suffered since. And then, of course, Putin is in Brazil now with the World Cup, which Russia is the next host of the World Cup. Then shortly thereafter, there will be this BRICS meeting in Brazil between the emerging economies of Brazil, India, China, and South Africa. We mentioned earlier how Brazil's already invested in this huge port project in Cuba. What's your sense of what might come out of this BRICS meeting in terms of Putin's presence there in Brazil?
Well, you know, as you probably know, the BRICS, first, all the BRIC countries, the five countries, have very good relations with Cuba. India and South Africa also have good relations with Cuba. So Cuba, of course, supports the BRICS. The BRICS are an effort by a number of countries to break out of the U.S. domination of the world economy. It's not complicated. They're talking about setting up their own development bank in competition with the IMF and the World Bank. So that whole meeting is about getting more independence from the United States. That's what it's all about. That's what the BRICS are all about.
And what's your sense of what's happening now in Brazil? Because obviously the World Cup has dominated life in Brazil of late. And as you know, the Brazilian team hasn't done well. And some analysts are now saying that there may be some blowback, if you will, against President Dilma Rousseff, who's up for election in October. Do you think there's any relationship between Brazil's team not doing well and the fortunes of Dilma Rousseff?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I'm not an expert on Brazil. I know very little about Brazil. It's a very important country, and one would have to spend many, many decades there to understand it. It's larger than the United States. I hope, you know, elections are not based on soccer games. And I would assume the Brazilians are not going to vote around soccer. They're going to vote around, you know, the bread and butter issues that everybody votes around. So without knowing anything about it, I would say I doubt it will have a serious impact on the election. I don't personally think that that will decide an election in Brazil.
Well, Mark Frank, I appreciate you joining us and giving us a flavor of how things are in Cuba and the recent visit by President Putin of Russia.
No, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Frank, who's in Cuba. He's a freelance journalist based in Cuba who has worked for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times. He consults for ABC News and has contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín, and is the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuban Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll look into the new economy and the Uber car phenomenon. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Mitchell, who's a professor of economics and a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, where he is the lead scholar on the project for the study of American capitalism. He has an op-ed in Sunday's Los Angeles Times, "If you like Uber, you would have loved the Jitney." Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Mitchell.
Thanks so much for having me.
And of course, Uber is a new car service along with Lyft and Sidecar, and it's thriving across the country, but it's also provoking a tremendous backlash. So is this what the Austrian economist referred to as creative destruction?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you're referring to Joseph Schumpeter's famous term, creative destruction. It's just the idea that disruptive innovations come along and they provide new and better services for consumers and also for producers. But at the same time, they inevitably challenge the status quo. And so you do get resistance. In this case, it's resistance from people, from firms that have essentially enjoyed regulatory protection from competition.
And of course, as you point out, the taxi services are not happy with Uber at all. Just for the benefit of the audience, tell me exactly what they do. I know I have friends who use Uber, and they find it incredibly efficient, pleasant, no money changes hands, it's very user-friendly, you don't have some surly Russian taxi driver that instead of taking you to Los Angeles International Airport takes you to Riverside, which has happened to my niece when she was visiting from Australia, and they ended up missing the plane. So lots of horror stories in the taxi department. And furthermore, one of the greatest examples of the political clout of the taxi lobby in Los Angeles is that the light rail stops a mile short of Los Angeles International Airport and dumps people in the middle of nowhere. Obviously, it was planned to go all the way to LAX, but the taxi lobby prevented that from happening.
That's interesting. They're building a subway out to Dulles Airport here, and I've noticed it does appear to stop before Dulles Airport. And I don't know if they're going to continue it or not, but I had never thought of that possibility, but that could be the same explanation out here in Washington, D.C. area as well.
If you wouldn't mind describing why this Uber, Lyft, and Sidecar, these new services, how they work and why they're popular and why they're growing and why they're a threat to the status quo.
Sure. So first let me just explain it from the perspective of the consumer, because it's actually different on both the supply side and the demand and the consumer side. So from the perspective of the consumer, the first time you sign up for Uber, you hold your credit card in front of it, and it reads your credit card, and it's connected to that. And then from then on out, you never ever have to pull out your credit card again. So then, when you need a ride, you just push a button, and a map comes up with available drivers in the area. You can opt for different options, and some of these are different options are available in different parts of the country. But where I am, you could have a UberX, which is basically, it's a decent car. It's not a luxury experience. You could have an Uber, which is a black car. It is a luxury experience. There's usually water and mints and that kind of thing. The driver steps out and opens the door for you. Or you can get a bigger SUV. So in any case, you push the button. A driver is usually assigned to you within seconds, and typically, at least where I am, they're available. They'll be at your house your location within 3 to 8 minutes. While you are waiting for them to show up, you can look and see what all the previous riders had experienced with them, because everybody who rides with Uber is prompted to rate the driver. And if you don't like what you see, of course, you can cancel the ride. That rarely happens because Uber itself stops working with riders who get whose average score dips below 4.6 out of 5 stars. So, from the driver's experience or the rider's experience, there's this really nice mechanism that just ensures that the rider has every incentive the driver has every incentive in the world to provide a good service because they are extremely accountable.
So, if the Uber chauffeur has interpersonal relations problems, they don't last. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the, this is a problem that essentially, for the better part of a century, regulators and cities have tried to achieve higher quality service among taxis through reams and reams of regulations that require everything from, you know, in some cities, air fresheners to, you know, requirements about the kinds of cars that they can drive and things like that. Well, you don't need to specify out in great detail, regulatory detail, all the requirements of a quality drive because people are smart enough to assess that themselves. And when you can rely on the ratings of the previous 10,000 customers, you know, that's a really effective system to make sure that these guys are on their best behavior.
And the people that drive you around, it's their own cars, right?
Yeah, so now let's talk about it from the supply side. The other part that's kind of innovative about this is these are not Uber or Lyft or sidecar employees. These people are folks like you and me who have a little bit of time on their hands and have an asset, a car, that is, it would otherwise be sitting idle in a garage somewhere or in a parking lot somewhere. And they're able to put these valuable assets, their cars and their time, to use. And so the other thing that's kind of interesting about the way the rating systems work is that the Uber drivers also rate the customers. So if you're a surly customer or you are a drunk college kid and you get sick in the back of the car and you don't pay, well, you are going to get a one, and you can be assured that the next time you ask for an Uber ride, you're not going to get one. So it's actually kind of ensures that both sides of the party are on their best behavior.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Mitchell, who's a professor of economics and a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, where he's the lead scholar on the project for the study of American capitalism. He has an op-ed in Sunday's Los Angeles Times, "If You Like Uber, You Would Have Loved the Jitney." And, of course, that article points out the jitney was the alternative at the turn of the century, or the turn of the last century, was alternative to the streetcar, and there was an equal backlash to it. So this is, as we talked about earlier, about Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction. How does this fit into the broader picture of changing capitalism in America via the web? Because one of the things that I understand that enables this thing to take place in the first place was an obscure part of an internet law. I think it was called the Internet Decency Law, Section 230, that Senator Udall put in, that allows companies to operate on the internet without being sued if, in terms of the internet not being a traditional publisher. There's also this room rental service called Airbnb, which is really hitting the hotel business, apparently impacting it fairly incredibly, particularly in New York, I understand. So how is this changing landscape in terms of winners and losers? Of course, you know, that is a sore point with a lot of people. You know, you throw a lot of people out of work and you make other people rich. So a lot of people like it and a lot of people don't.
Yeah, that's right. It's one of a large number of products that people are calling the peer-to-peer economy, or sometimes they call it the share economy or the peer production economy. And it's the idea that basically everyday people can become producers or sellers of products or services. So there's Airbnb, which allows you to rent out your house as a hotel. There is something called Flight Car, which when you park your car at an airport and go off on a trip, you can then turn your car into a rental car. And that way, when you come back, instead of getting a bill for having your car in the garage for 3 days, you get a check for being able to rent it out to people. There's things that allow you to share your dog if you are going out of town for a weekend. There's things that allow you, something called 1000tools.com, that allows you to borrow people's tools or loan people your tools. So all of these things are, of course, going to challenge the status quo. Now, one of the things that I'd emphasize is that the challenge is, in many cases, harder in those industries where the status quo is essentially protected by the law. So people often have this perspective that regulation is always, pro-consumer and often, you know, burdensome for the regulated firm. In reality, though, we see that a lot of regulations are favored by the industries, and that's because instead of ensuring consumer welfare, what they end up doing is limiting supply, which, go back to Econ 101, when you limit supply, prices increased. And so in many cases, it essentially permits a cartelization that the industries probably would not be able to get but for this regulation limiting supply.
So given that there's actually a word that was coined by the futurist Alvin Toffler, it's called a prosumer. In other words, it's a conflation of producer and consumer, that we could become prosumers. And that sounds like what you're talking about here. But what about regulation? What about, you know, the fact that taxis are regulated, albeit I mentioned that example of my niece being taken to the wrong airport that's, you know, hundreds of miles away. What about the insurance? You rent a room, at least you know what you're getting in a hotel and there's somebody you can complain to. So how does that work?
Yeah, so the first thing to go back to is, let's go back to the original rationale for why a lot of these industries are regulated in the first place. And the usual story that economists would tell is something like, we would use the phrase asymmetric information. And the idea here is that when you are hailing a cab on the street as it whizzes by, you have way less information about the quality of the cab than the cab driver has. You can't assess how good a driver the driver is. You don't even know how clean the inside of the cab is or whether the guy knows his way around. Once you open the door, you might be able to assess a few of those things, but then in many cases, you're sort of in a monopoly situation because you don't know when the next cab is going to come along. So, you know, historically, the rationale has been that consumers are at a disadvantage, so we need to regulate this. Regulators need to preemptively screen and assess the quality of drivers. So what's interesting here is that the new technology, as I said, sort of is allowing consumers a way to assess quality far better than the reams or regulations have ever been able to do. In addition to, you know, being able to see how previous riders have assessed the quality, if you have a bad experience, it's incredibly accountable because you can immediately identify the driver. You know, if there's a GPS record, your cell phone tells Uber or Lyft or Sidecar exactly which driver it was who gave you a bad record. You know, even if you had a bad record, I don't know what your niece did, but if she had a bad experience with the taxi, it's not easy to figure out exactly how to identify the right taxi. You got to write down the number, you got to call it in and make a complaint, and you don't know, you know, if they're going to follow up on it or if they have an incentive to follow up on it. But Uber and Lyft and Sidecar, you know, have a real strong incentive to follow up. So now here's the question, though. To me, the relevant question is, we have these old regulations that may have made sense 30 or 40 years ago, or even 5 or 10. And these taxi cabs, I think, have a legitimate complaint that they have to deal with these old regulations. Why don't the new guys have to deal with them?
So what is the future, though, of the market? If Uber becomes a monopoly and can drive the prices down, there's this term in economics, the elasticity of demand. Is there a dark side to the idea that you have, a behemoth? Because quite often that happens on the Internet, doesn't it? I mean, Facebook is a behemoth, you know, Google's a behemoth. They start out as innovators in terms of competition, but they end up being monopolies.
Potentially. So one thing to think about is, you know, what are the characteristics that we usually associate with a monopoly? A monopoly actually typically is, when economists get concerned about it, it's a firm that is an exclusive seller and therefore is able to limit supply and raise the price. The two examples you gave are firms, of course, that give away their products essentially for free. And in the case of Uber or Lyft, Uber's not the only one. We've got Lyft, we've got Sidecar. At this point, there isn't a lot of evidence that they are, you know, driving prices super high or diminishing quality. If anything, you know, UberX offers prices that are the same or lower than taxis, and the quality appears to be higher. So, you know, a lot of people have a concern about monopolies that eventually, once they take over, they're going to get into a second phase that, you know, once they've driven everybody else out of the market, they're going to come into a second phase where they're suddenly going to raise prices. But the real concern is that I have, actually, is that maybe Uber and Lyft will come in and obtain the same kinds of regulatory limits the taxis did. That, to me, is a much more legitimate concern than that just through market forces they're going to be able to capture the market.
And that, of course, relates to our money-driven political system, right? If our politicians are up for sale, then they can be bought by the highest bidder.
Yeah, it has to do with money, and it also has to do with a willingness of politicians to essentially indulge businesses with privileges. So when Uber was finally... When Uber first came to D.C., the D.C. City Council proposed legislation that would have said that they could not charge anything less than five times what taxis charge. And in sort of an amazing display of candor, the City Council had a section called Explanation and Rationale, some language that said this is to make sure that Uber does not compete with taxis. So there was this big outcry. Uber's several thousand happy customers started complaining to the D.C. City Council. They were inundated with complaints. Within about 48 hours, the legislation was withdrawn. This seems good, except that then when the City Council finally got together with Uber, they managed to get legislation that created a new category of license that Uber fit into. Well, the interesting thing is some of Uber's competitors, like Sidecar, did not fit that category. So essentially, they began playing the same game the taxis and taxi companies have played for a century.
But just in closing, Matthew Mitchell, in the broader sense, I guess in the macroeconomic sense, if that's not being too portentous, this is an example, I think, of a new economy that's emerging that has some aspects of bartering, people sort of assets that they can monetize that otherwise sort of lie fallow. There are some good sides to it, are there not? There's also...
Absolutely. So, and I think it's absolutely appropriate to think about it in the macroeconomic perspective. There's a late economist from the University of Maryland named Nancy Olson who wrote a book called The Rise and Decline of Nations, and it's all about the fact that nations and societies that essentially are open or new forms of doing business are those that thrive, but those in which entrenched interests manage to co-opt the political system and use it to limit competition and protect their particular narrow monopoly interests, those are the ones that die. And you need look no further than, say, the Habsburg dynasty and see... Empress Maria Theresa has this quote where she suggests, whenever anybody went to her with a suggestion of a new way of doing things, she said, leave everything as it is. And, societies that try to leave everything as is, they are societies that eventually ossify and fail to grow.
And in the case of the Habsburgs, start World War One, which the 100th anniversary of which is coming up. Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Matthew Mitchell.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Mitchell, who's a professor of economics and a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, where he's the lead scholar on the Project for the Study of American Capitalism. He has an op-ed in Sunday's Los Angeles Times. If you like Uber, you would have loved the jitney. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.